You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Light Course. This is Lecture 7 given in Stuttgart on December 30th, 1919. Today we begin with an experiment that will tie in, once again, to our observations on color theory. Of course, as I've said, it's only possible for me to present you with something of an improvised, more or less aphoristic nature in these lectures. For that reason, I'll also have to avoid the usual categories you find in physics books. I don't mean to say that it would be better if I could keep to these categories. However, I would like to guide you to a certain insight into the natural sciences, so please regard everything I present before that as a kind of preparation, which isn't done by progressing in a straight line, as is otherwise the custom, but by gathering the phenomena we need and creating a circle, so to speak, then pressing forward to the central point. As you have seen, when colors appear, we are dealing with an interaction of light and darkness. Now, it's a matter of observing as many real phenomena as possible before coming to conclusions about the actual causes of this interaction of light and darkness. So today, I would first like to show you the phenomenon of the so-called colored shadows. See Figure 7a. Using this rod, I'm going to produce shadows from two sources of light, represented by these little candles here on the screen across from you. You see two shadows that have no distinct color. If you take a close look at what is here, you have to say that the shadow you see here on the right side is produced by this light source, left. Of course, and that it results from the fact that the light is emitted from this source and blocked by the rod. And that shadow is the one that results when the light from our right-handed light source is blocked. Basically, in other words, we are dealing here only with the creation of certain dark spaces. What lies in shadow is just a dark space. If you look at the surface of the screen outside the two shadow bands, you will realize that it is illuminated by the two light sources. So, in other words, we are dealing here with light. Now I am going to color one of the lights. I will have it pass through a tinted glass plate so that one of the lights is colored. We know what's going to happen now. One of the lights will be dimmed. But now, you see, because of the dimming of the light, this shadow, right, which is caused by the rod covering my left light source, turns green. It turns green in the same way that, for example, a white surface turns green when you look directly at a small red surface, then avert your eyes from it and focus them on the white surface. Then what you first saw as red turns green without anything being there. It's as if you were projecting the green color itself onto the surface. Just as in that case you see the green surface as the after image of the red surface you saw before, here you see the shadow of the light source because I am dimming it with red. Thus, what was formerly merely darkness, you now see as green. Now watch what happens if I dim the same light source with green. As you see, then the shadow appears red. If I dim the same light source with blue, then as you can see, the shadow appears orange. If I were to dim the light source with violet, then yellow would result. Now I'd like you to consider the following. This particular phenomenon is of great significance, so I'll mention it one more time. If you have, say, a red cushion with a white crocheted cover with diamond-shaped openings, and you look first at the red diamonds and then at the white part, you see the same lattice effect of green on the white. Of course, it's not really there, but your eye creates an after effect, which produces so-called subjective green images when you focus on the white. Goethe knew of this last phenomenon, and he was also acquainted with the phenomenon of the colored shadows. He said to himself, quote, "I dim this light source, and I get green. Close quote. And then he describes it as follows, quote, if I dim the light source here, then the entire white screen is covered with a red light. And I don't actually see the white screen. Instead, I see a red light. I see the screen as red. Because of this, I'm producing the contrasting color green with my eye, just as with the cushion. Thus, there isn't any real green. Rather, I just see it incidentally, because the screen is colored red. Close quote. This view of Goethe's is wrong. You can easily persuade yourself that it is wrong. For if you take a small tube and look through it, so that after the light has been dimmed, you are looking only at this green band, then you will still see it as green. You're not seeing what surrounds it. Rather, you're only seeing the green, which is objectively present at that spot. By doing this, by dimming here and then looking at the green, you can persuade yourself that the green is objective. It stays green, and thus can't be a contrast phenomenon. It is an objective phenomenon. We can't make it possible for everybody to see it individually, but, quote, the truth be known when two are shown, close quote. I will produce the phenomenon, and you should look through so that you see the green band. It stays green, doesn't it? Just as the other color would stay red if I produced red with green. In this case, Goethe incorporated his error into his theory of color, and naturally it has to be corrected. First, I want you to do nothing more than to keep the facts in mind from the many different kinds of phenomena I have shown you. If we saturate the shadow, gray in other words, darkness, which otherwise appears merely as a shadow, with color, so to speak, then light and dark interact in a different way than when the shadow isn't saturated with a color. And let's remember that by darkening the light with red here, we cause the objective appearance of green. Now, I've pointed out the so-called subjective phenomenon to you. We have a so-called objective phenomenon, the green, which remains on the screen, even if it is not fixed, as long as we create the conditions for it. And then something here, which to a certain extent is subjective and dependent on our eyes alone. Goethe calls the green color that appears to me when I have exposed my eyes to a color for a while, the, in quotes, required color, the required after image, which is caused by the reaction itself. Now there is something to keep firmly in mind. The differentiation between the subjective and the objective, between the color that is temporarily fixed here and the color that is apparently only a color required as an after image, has no justification on the basis of objective facts. When I am seeing the red here with my eyes, I am dealing simply with all the pieces of physical equipment I have described to you, the vitreous body, the lens, the fluid between the lens and the cornea. I am dealing with a highly differentiated physical apparatus. The relationship of this physical equipment, which mixes light and dark with each other in the most varied ways, to the objectively extant ether, is no different than that of the pieces of equipment I have set up here, the screen, the rod, etc. In the one instance, the entire setup, the entire machinery is just my eye, and I see an objective phenomenon with my eye. Only here the phenomenon lasts. If, however, by looking, I prepare my eye so that afterward it operates in the so-called subjective required color, then the eye returns in its conditions to a neutral state. However, the process by which I see green is not at all different when I see it in a so-called subjective way with my eyes than when I objectively fix my gaze on it here. That's why I said you don't live subjectively in such a way that the color out there makes vibrations whose effect is expressed as color. Rather, you float in the ether. You are the one with it. And whether you become one with the ether by means of the equipment here, or by means of what takes place in your eyes themselves, is just a different series of events. There is no real essential difference between the green image that has been produced in space by darkening with red and the green after image that only appears temporarily. Looked at objectively, there isn't a tangible difference. Only, in one instance, the process takes place in space, while in the other instance it takes place in time. That's the only intrinsic difference. If you pursue the essence of these things, it will lead you to understand the opposition of the so-called subjective and objective as it really is, not in the wrong sense in which it is continually understood in the modern natural sciences. In the one instance, we have a setup to produce colors, and our eyes remain neutral. That is, they make themselves neutral vis-à-vis the emergence of color. In other words, the eye becomes one with what is there. In the other instance, the eye itself acts as a physical apparatus. However, whether this physical apparatus is here, outside, or in your frontal sinus is all the same. We are not outside of things and don't just project phenomena into space. We are thoroughly in things with our being and are in things all the more as we ascend from certain physical phenomena to other physical phenomena. No unbiased person who investigates color phenomena can do anything but admit that we are not in them with our ordinary bodily nature, but with our etheric, and therefore with our astral nature. If we descend from light to heat, which we also perceive as something that is a condition of our surroundings, and which acquires significance when we are exposed to it, we will soon see that there is a significant difference between the way we perceive light and the way we perceive heat. You can localize the perception of light in the physical apparatus of the eye, whose objective significance I have just characterized. In the case of heat, what do you have to say to yourself? If you really ask yourself how you can compare the relationship that you have to light with the relationship you have to heat, you have to answer as follows. My relationship to light is limited by my eyes, so to speak, to a specific place in my body. That's not the way it is in the case of heat. Here I am more or less all sense organ. I am to heat just as the light is to I am to heat just as the eye is to light. Thus we can't speak in the same localized sense about the perception of heat as we can about the perception of light. However, just by turning our attention to something of this kind, we can arrive at yet another point. What are we actually perceiving when we enter into a relationship with the heat element of our surroundings? Indeed, we actually perceive this floating in the element of heat in our surroundings very clearly. Only, what is floating? I'd like you to answer that question for yourself. What is it that actually floats there when you are floating in the heat of your surroundings? Let's take the following experiment. Fill a trough with moderately warm water, with water that feels lukewarm to you when you put both hands in it. Don't put them in long, just test it. Then do the following. First, put your left hand in water that is as hot as you can stand it. Then put your right hand in water that is as cold as possible, and then stick the left and the right quickly in the lukewarm water. You will see that the lukewarm water seems very warm to the right hand and very cold to the left hand. The heated left hand perceives as cold the same thing that the cooled right hand perceives as heat. Before, you felt a uniform lukewarm temperature. What part of you is it that floats in the heat element of your surroundings? It is your own heat, which is produced by your own organic process. It isn't something unconscious. Your consciousness lives within it. Inside your skin, you live in your body heat, and depending on what this is, you come to terms with the element of heat in your surroundings. Your own body heat floats within it. Your heat organism floats in the environment. If you think such things through, you will approach the real processes of nature quite differently than by means of what current physics can offer you, which is completely abstracted and removed from all reality. Now, however, let us descend even further. We have seen that we can say that when we experience our own heat condition, we do so because we float together with it in our heat environment. Thus, when we are warmer than our surroundings, we experience them as draining us. When the surroundings are cold, and when we are colder, we experience the environment as giving us something. It's quite another thing if we are living in a different element. You see, we can live in that which is the basis of light. We float in the element of light. We have just discussed how we float in the element of heat. But we can also float in the element of air, which we actually have continuously within us. Indeed, we are solid bodies only in very small measure. Our bodies are only to a small extent solid. We are actually over 90% a column of water. And particularly in us, water is only an intermediate state between the airy and solid states. We certainly can experience ourselves in the airy element, just as we experience ourselves in the element of heat. In other words, our consciousness effectively descends into the airy element. Just as it enters into the elements of light and heat, our consciousness also enters into the element of air. By entering into the element of air, it can in turn come to terms with what happens in the air surrounding us. And this coming to terms is what manifests itself in the phenomenon of sound or tone. We have to differentiate different levels of our consciousness. With one level, we live in the element of light by taking part in it ourselves. With a different level, we live in the element of heat by taking part in it ourselves. And with yet another level of our consciousness, we live in the element of air by taking part in it ourselves. Because our consciousness is capable of descending into the gaseous, airy element, we live in the airy element of our surroundings and are thus able to perceive acoustical phenomena, to perceive sound phenomena. Just as we ourselves have to take part consciously in light phenomena in order to be able to float in the light phenomena of our surroundings, and we ourselves have to take part consciously in the element of heat in order to be able to float in it, in the same way, we also have to take part in the airy element. We must have something airy differentiated within us in order to be able to perceive differentiated airy things, let's say a pipe, a drum, or a violin. In this respect, our organism presents something extraordinarily interesting. We breathe air out. Our breathing process, of course, consists of breathing air out and breathing air in again. When we breathe air out, we push the diaphragm upward. Connected to this, however, the entire system of organs beneath the diaphragm is relieved of strain. Because we raise the diaphragm when breathing out, the cerebrospinal fluid, in which the brain floats, is pushed downward to a degree. However, the cerebrospinal fluid is nothing more than a condensed modification, if I may say so, of the air. For in truth, it is the exhaled air that causes this action. When I breathe in again, the cerebrospinal fluid is pushed upward. Thus, by breathing, I live continuously in this upward and downward swinging of the cerebrospinal fluid, which is a clear reproduction of the entire process of breathing. If I live consciously in the fact that my organism takes part in these oscillations of the breathing process, then there is an inner differentiation in my experience of the airy element of consciousness. Through this process, which I have described only roughly, I am placed continuously within a life rhythm consisting, both in its origins and in its course, of the differentiation of air. What takes place here internally when you breathe? differentiated not so crudely, of course, but in diverse ways, this upward and downward swinging of the rhythmic forces may itself be described as a complex, continuously rising and falling oscillation organism. We cause this internal organism of oscillation to collide in our ear with sounds coming to us from the outside, for example, when a string is struck. And just as you perceive the heat of your own hand when you dip it into lukewarm water, by comparing the difference between the heat of your hand and the heat of the water, you perceive the corresponding tone or sound by comparing your wonderfully constructed inner musical instrument with the phenomenon in the air that manifests itself as tones or sounds. The ear is only the bridge that your inner Apollonian lyre uses to balance itself in its relationship with the differentiated air movements coming to you from the outside. If I portray it in real terms, the actual process of hearing, namely differentiated sounds or tones, is quite distinct from that abstraction whereby they say that something outside acts to affect my ear and the effect is perceived as an effect on my subjective being, which in turn they describe, but with what terminology, or actually don't describe. No matter which idea is used as the basis here, we can't get any further if we want to think things through clearly. We can't come to a conclusion about certain things that are commonly taken up simply because this kind of physics is far from going into the facts. In terms of the facts, you are dealing with three stages of the relationships of human beings to the outer world: the light stage, the heat stage, and the sound or acoustic stage. However, there is something very peculiar here. If you examine without bias your relationship with light, that is to say, you're floating in the element of light, then you have to say that you can only inhabit the processes of the outside world as an ether organism. By inhabiting the element of heat, you are living with your entire organism in the element of heat of your surroundings. Now, direct your attention downward from this aspect of living within these elements into the inhabitation of the sound and tone element. In this case, by becoming yourself an organism of the air, you actually inhabit differentiated forms of the outer air. In other words, you no longer inhabit the ether, but actually live in the external physical substance. You inhabit the air in this case. For this reason, life in the element of heat is a significant dividing line. To a certain extent, the element of heat, living within it, means a middle level of your consciousness. You can perceive this level very clearly in the fact that for all intents and purposes, you can hardly distinguish outer and inner heat in terms of pure sensation. However, life in the element of light lies above this level. You ascend into a higher etheric sphere, so to speak, in order to inhabit it with your consciousness. And you penetrate below that middle level, where you balance yourself out with the outer world in relatively simple fashion, by coming to terms with the air in the perception of tones or sounds. If you put everything I have just shown you together with what I have said about anatomy and physiology, then you can't help but regard the eye as a piece of physical equipment. The farther you move toward the outside, the more physical you find the eye to be. The farther you move inside, the more it is permeated by vitality. Thus we have within us a localized organ to raise us above the middle level. On this middle level, we live on equal terms with the environment when we approach it with our heat and perceive the difference somewhere. In this instance, we have no specialized organ such as the eye. Here, in a way, we ourselves turn completely into a sense organ. Now we dive down under this level, in the element where we turn into beings of the air, where we come to terms with the differentiated outer air. This conflict is localized once again. something is localized there between the outer air and the process that is taking place within us, in this Apollonian lyre, this rhythmic play of our organism, which is simply reproduced in the rhythmization of the cerebrospinal fluid. What takes place there is connected by a bridge. Once again, there is a localization of this kind, but now it is below this middle level. Just as in the case of the eye, we have such a localization above this level. Our psychology, you see, is actually in even a worse state than our physiology and physics. And we can't really blame the physicists very much for expressing themselves so unrealistically about what is in the outer world, because they are not supported at all by the psychologists. The psychologists have been conditioned by the churches, which have staked a claim to all knowledge about the soul and spirit. Therefore, this conditioning, which the psychologists have accepted, has led them to regard the human being as only the outer apparatus, and to see soul and spirit only in the sounds of words, in phrases. Our psychology is actually only a collection of words, for there's nothing there about what people should understand by, in quotes, soul and, in quotes, spirit. And that's why it appears to the physicists that it is an inner subjective experience when light, at work out there, affects the eye and the eye counteracts it or receives the impression, as the case may be. A whole tangle of ambiguities begins right there, and the physicists repeat this in quite the same way for the other sense organs. If you read through books on psychology these days, you'll find it to be a theory of sense perception. They speak of sense in general, as if there were such a thing. Just try studying the eye, EYE. It's something quite different from the ear. I've characterized that for you, how they lie above and below this middle level. The eye and the ear are organs with an inner formation of quite different kinds, and that is what we should take into consideration in a significant way. Let's stop here for the moment. Think that over, and tomorrow we'll talk about acoustics, the theory of sound, from this point of view, so that starting from there you will be able to master in turn the other areas of physics. Today I would like to show you just one more thing. It is something that in a certain respect we could call the piece de resistance of modern physics. It is indeed in a certain respect a piece de resistance. If you simply stroke a surface with your finger, thus exerting pressure by your own effort, the surface becomes warm. By exerting pressure, you have produced heat. By creating objective mechanical processes that are definitely mechanical, we can, once again, produce heat. So, as another basis for what we want to look at tomorrow, we have improvised this apparatus. If you check the temperature in this apparatus, you would get a reading of 16 degrees Celsius, more or less. Now we have water in this receptacle. And in this body of water there is a flywheel, a drum that we cause to turn rapidly, so that it does mechanical work, stirring up the water thoroughly, scooping the water up. Then after a bit we'll look at the temperature. You will see then that it has risen. Thus the temperature of the water has increased purely by mechanical work. In other words, heat is produced by mechanical work. This was worked up then initially in the form of calculations after Julius Robert Meyer, in particular, pointed it out. Julius Robert Meyer himself formulated it as the so-called mechanical equivalent of heat. If it had been developed further according to his ideas, we would have said nothing more than that a certain number is the expression for the measurable heat divided by mechanical work, and vice versa. However, this was analyzed in a supernatural, metaphysical way when it was stated thus: if there is a constant relationship between the work that has been done and the heat, then the latter is simply transformed work. Transformed! Whereas we are dealing for the moment with nothing but the numerical expression for the connection between mechanical work and heat. The end of Lecture 7.